Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of Color and Ceramics Podcast. Today, I'm really pleased to be speaking with Peter Beard, a British ceramic artist whose work beautifully bridges design and sculpture. Peter first discovered clay as a kid, and that early fascination never really left him. While studying industrial and furniture design at Ravensbourne College of Art in London, he found himself spending more and more time in the ceramics department. After graduating, he helped set up a pottery in Scotland, making domestic stoneware, and not long after, he opened his own studio in Kent, where sculpture became his main focus. These days, Peter works from his studio in Leamington Spa, creating stoneware pieces that are both thrown and hand-built. He fires in oxidation to around 1280 degrees C, building up layers of colored clay and matte glazes, using wax resist and surface grinding to reveal these intricate textured patterns underneath. He's also worked in bronze and stone and has been exhibiting his work since the mid-1970s, both in Britain and internationally. What I love most about Peter's approach is how design precision meets quiet emotion. Each piece feels carefully considered, but deeply human. I hope you really enjoy today's show. Peter, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Color and Ceramics Podcast. We are super excited about having you here because we think that your work, the color and surface that you produce in your work, is really perfect for this podcast to have a conversation. So welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, that's kind of you. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Now, you've been at this a little while, I understand.
Professionally, I started in 1973. I discovered clay when I was eight, which would have been 1959. I was absolutely fascinated by it, but I didn't understand, obviously, anything about possibilities. So it was just something that I just found fascinating.
Yeah. It's funny how I talk to people and almost everybody talks about this notion of touching the clay. And I mean, I've called it getting addicted to it, but becoming enamored with clay and what it can do. And it's interesting for me about how many people have come from one career to another and touched clay and that was it. That was the end of
it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your journey once you started getting into it at school, and can you kind of give us a summary of, I mean, that's a long number of years, so I don't expect you to go the whole.
I've been very fortunate in many ways because when I was eight, this teacher brought some clay into school. We were allowed to model things. There was no kiln or any firing or anything. I still have a memory, though I'm sure it's a reinforced memory over years, of making a sort of typical boy's space rocket and painting it blue with post paint. And somehow I knew, somebody must have told me, that if I took this piece of dry clay home and put it in water, it would go back to being soft clay. And I remember doing this and then just modeling, getting it back to soft clay and just modeling. There's no history in my family of, I had an uncle who was an architect, but apart from that, there's no creative people in my family whatsoever. So I don't know where it all came from, but I was, and I was born in the north of England in a town called Southport in Lancashire. And my father, who was in the shipping industry, got a job with a shipping company in London. So we moved down to the very outskirts of the south of London. And at the end of the road was a pottery. And it was run by a very eccentric woman who made slipcast children's nightlights. And I, as a very shy 10-year-old went and knocked on her door and asked her if I could have some clay. She gave me half a bag of clay, which I couldn't even carry, so I had to drag it all the way home. And I then made a little corner in the garden shed and just modeled, the pets and just played around. I didn't fire anything. And then when I was a bit older, I, like a lot of kids, you get a job like a paper round or something like that. I got a Saturday job there working in the pottery, just doing, really kind of simple sort of jobs. But it just, I don't know, I just loved it, absolutely loved it. And at school holidays, she gave me a job. And the woman who ran it was very eccentric, but incredibly generous, incredibly kind. And she helped me. And I also bought a book, or I was given it as a Christmas present, I can't remember, which was called Ceramic Sculpture by John B. Kenny. And I could quote that book word for word. I knew it backwards. I read it and read it and read it and read it, and I tried kind of various things in it and played around and all the rest of it. And then when I was a bit older, the school that I was at, which had a very advanced art course, decided that it ought to have ceramics as part of the things that it did. So it opened a little ceramics department, and that helped. And then it was time to go to college. I wanted to do something with ceramics. My parents were absolutely dead against that because I needed to get a proper job. My father then died. Around this time, and luckily my teacher at school told my mother that if I got a job in commercial art, which by his standards was graphic design, there was a good career in this, and I could earn some money. So she was happy for me then to go to art school, and because she was now on her own, I only decided to go to the local art school. And I decided, because I was also really enjoyed doing woodwork and things, because my father did a lot of woodwork and stuff just as a hobby. And he, sorry, and so I actually went to the college to study industrial design and furniture design. And that is the degree that I have. And actually, that was one of the best things that I ever did, because it taught me a lot about a lot of other things, which had been very useful when, making display stands for shows, or, mounting work in very different ways or whatever. But at the college, they had a small ceramics department, and you were allowed to do ceramics a day a week, or another subject. You could do ceramics or jewelry. So I chose ceramics. And actually, what ended up happening was that the people in the industrial design department would set a project. I would do it in about 2 days, badly. They would then never see me for the 6 weeks or whatever of this project. They got to a point where they decided that they were going to throw me out of college because I was never there and my projects were never any good. But they hadn't kind of worked out that actually I was in the ceramics department. And so the ceramics department guys, the chap who ran it was, which was a man called Graham Burr, very interesting guy. He invited them all down to see what I'd been doing. And of course, I'd been doing, rubbish stuff, for student-y kind of stuff, but I'd been doing tons and tons of it. And basically, they then said that I could stay at college as long as I made two pieces of furniture for my final degree show, and the rest of it could be ceramics. So I made a piece of furniture in ceramics, and I made some pieces of furniture in wood. And then I had lots of kind of, bits of ceramics and projects that Graham Burr had set me to sort of help me on my way, kind of thing. And I was then very lucky because while I was in the ceramics department, a tutor in the graphic design department used to come down in the evenings and at lunch times to learn to throw, because him and his wife had a dream of going to Scotland and setting up a pottery. And I'm half Scottish, so, and I go to Scotland, over the years a lot, so I kind of know it very well. And at the end of my degree show, they offered me a job because they thought that I knew a lot more about ceramics than I actually did, but I did know more than they did. And so I went up to the Highlands of Scotland. Which again was a very good learning situation because we moved into a completely empty building. We had to build a gas kiln, build shelvings to make a for the just the making, then build some kind of shop for because it was quite a tourist area. And we designed and made a range of domestic ware, and which we sold to passing tourists. And I did that for about a year, and then, like most people, young people, I was pretty much in the middle of nowhere in a village of, I don't know, 200 people at the most. And I wanted more of the bright lights and all the rest of it. So I then went back down to London and I got a job as a technician in the ceramics department of the same college I'd studied at. And that gave me a wage. The woman who ran the pottery that I had worked in as a child, her business was going through a bad time because she used to employ about five to six people. And so she had a room free because she hadn't got enough people. I hadn't got anywhere to live. So she let me sleep in her spare bedroom. And I think I was there for about a year or 18 months, and fed me and charged me next to nothing rent, and I signed on what was then called in England is called Social Security, where it's basically if you haven't got a job. And I made a pledge to myself that as soon as I was earning the same amount of money that I was getting from the government each week, I would stop taking the money from the government and then carry on with my making work. And basically, my stint of making domestic ware in Scotland taught me that the last thing I wanted to do was be a domestic thrower, because I couldn't stand the, oh, right, now we've got to make 45 mugs now, and then, right, I've got to make 20 plates, and then I've got to get five teapots, and it was just a kind of never ending thing. And I realized that I wanted to make individual work, so I started making individual work, and I have been making individual work ever since. And there's a magazine which I'm sure you know of called Ceramic Review in the UK. And so I looked in the back of Ceramic Review at the galleries that were advertising, and if any of those galleries were selling the work of people who I admired, then I mean, in those days there was no internet, so I sent them a letter saying, can I come and show you what I've been doing? And one or two of them said yes, and one or two of them took work. And then one or two of them said, would you like to put a couple of pieces in this group exhibition? And then, it just built and built and built from there, basically. So that's basically how it all sort of started. So.
Very cool. It's interesting how we learn not only the technical and creative skills of ceramics in our careers, but we also learn the business side and learn what you like to do and what you don't like to do. And it sounds
Yeah.
like that came early for you.
Well, I mean, that was kind of good. I mean, I think one of the things that I missed out on is that I'm not very knowledgeable about, or at that time, I mean, I'm more knowledgeable now, but I'm, and maybe I'm more knowledgeable than I think I am, but I'm not that knowledgeable on sort of clays and glazes and those kind of things, because I wasn't really at a college that had a ceramic degree course where they would have in lots of visiting lecturers of people who would, come and demonstrate their wares and talk to you, and you could talk to them and all the rest of it. So it, in a way, apart from help from Graham Burr when I was at college, I'm pretty much sort of self-taught in a way. And I suppose I'm quite determined if I want to do something. And if I think it can be done, if I decide to make a piece of work which seems almost impossible, but I think it can be done, then I'll just keep going until I have done it. I might not do it very well, but I'll make sure that because you learn. I've always realized that you learn whatever you do, and whatever mistakes you make, or setbacks you have, or whatever, as long as you can work through them, they are all part of an education process. And that education process, enhances what you do, really. So.
I totally agree with you that practice and problem solving and all go together in terms of taking your art to the next level, if you're open to that. You know, that I think sometimes an attitude of a person might hold them back if they're nervous or don't like to experience failure in some ways. Although I think if they're into clay, they have to be able to tolerate experimentation and failures, because it seems like it comes with us.
But I mean, a good example, I think, in terms of the sort of more the kind of business side, because I've never been, now if you go to college, you get taught all about the business side and all the rest of it. But we had I can't remember what year it was now, but we had a really bad recession in the UK, and I had a friend who was a close friend who was living in Germany, who was actually part German, but lived most of his life in England, but was now living in Germany. And I just got a list of all the what I thought were, I suppose, could be good galleries in German. And I got in Germany, and I got him, I sent him a series of letters for him to post them to all these galleries, to tell them that between these two dates I was coming to Germany, and I had basically filled my car with work and just spent 2 weeks touring around Germany, calling at these places, showing them all my stuff. Some people took stuff, some people didn't take stuff, and that started a whole journey of going outside the UK to sell work. I mean, I've got a lot of colleagues, who are kind of very successful, but they pretty much only sell their work in the UK unless somebody comes and knocks on their door. They don't tend to sort of go out. But I've always kind of felt that, I mean, my mother always said to me that if you don't ask, you don't get. So I've always kind of thought, well, what's the worst thing people can say is no. So, I mean, it's an old cliche, but I mean, it is quite true in a way. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I think you're right. We need to, as creative folks, take a chance and get out there and ask for what we want. Often we don't do that. Hey, you recently, when you and I were back and forth over the last year about coming on to this podcast interview, you said you had gone to China and you were
Yeah, I've been. I mean, I'm actually going to China in about 4 weeks. Again, basically, I was invited to do a residency at Jingdezhen University. They have an international school. Well, no, actually, originally I went to China. There was in I think it was 1982. The editor of Ceramic Review and another person wanted, China was just beginning to allow people to visit, and they spent the previous 3 years from 1982 persuading the Chinese government to allow a party of potters, museum people, and writers to come and tour China to look at ceramics. Anyway, they finally got permission, and I was again very fortunate that an aunt that I didn't really know very well had died. She left me a sum of money, which was exactly the amount of money that this trip would cost. And I kind of thought, well, I could kind of save this money, and I thought I'm never going to get this opportunity. So I went on this trip, which was amazing. And China's such an interesting place, and that sort of sowed a seed about China. Anyway, then in 2019, I got invited to do this residency, which I went to do and absolutely loved it. And I have done various residencies over the years in various countries. I kind of aim to try and do one every 2 years if I can. And I use them as an opportunity rather than doing the work that I do. Everybody who I know has got ideas for things that they never have the time to actually develop. Or if they do want to develop them, instead of it taking sort of 3 months to make big strides, it takes them 3 years because they're fitting it in with all the usual things that they have to do. So I always take residencies as an opportunity to try something basically completely different. And most of the things that I've ever made in these things, you would never know that it was made by me. So I did that one, and that was fantastic. And then I came home, and then that was just I what was that 2019? Yes, that was I think just before COVID. I just came home just before COVID. And then I in 2024 I got asked again to go back to a different kind of center in basically this is all in Jingdezhen. And so it's an opportunity to work in porcelain, which I have worked in when I was much, much younger, but I haven't worked in for a long, long time. And so I went for that residency, which was 2 months. Unfortunately, I had an accident towards the end and broke three ribs, so I couldn't work anymore. So I came home early, and I never really completed what I want to do. So I'm now going back to the same thing, to basically do what I should have done and not fall over and break three ribs again. So, but I find China a really interesting country because it is has achieved a most amazing development in a very short period of time. And the people are lovely, the food's great, there's lots of interesting things, and you've just learned such a tremendous amount. I mean, particularly, I mean, obviously, I'm in the ceramics field, so that's what I kind of see most of. But it's, yeah, I just really enjoy it. So, and I'm very lucky that my wife is, you know, sort of says, yep, you can go and spend another 2 months away because obviously she has to pick up all the jobs that I normally do as, you know, we're working at home. So I'm very grateful for that. So that's
Yeah,
good.
Very cool. Now, I'm going to ask you about your work that you're known for, and
Right.
but I wonder if you could give us a hint about what it is that you're doing in China that's different and new, and nobody would know what it's you. Nobody'd know it was you.
Right. Well, basically, I'm working in porcelain. So that's a kind of first thing. I'm firing with gas and I'm firing to 1320 and I fire in oxidation. So again, there's completely different glaze qualities. And I'm actually trying to make the surfaces that I make or the patterns that I make, but make them three-dimensional. And I did a whole load of tests when I was there and achieved what I wanted to do. I did manage to fire a couple of pieces of work which came out very well. But because part of the deal of the residency is that I have to leave a certain amount of work for them, I decided to leave, everything that I made apart from, I think I brought two tiny little things home in a suitcase just as a kind of memory in a way. So if they were in an exhibition with my work, you could see the relationship. But if you walked into somewhere and an exhibition and there wasn't a name tag or whatever, you would not, because they're all, I mean, most of my glazes are kind of matte and semi-matte, and these things are all very shiny and glossy and runny and all the rest of it. So, it's just a different kind of approach.
Yeah, what a cool opportunity for you.
It is, it's great. Yeah, no, I'm
Yeah.
very lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about your work. I mean, people, I'm hoping after they listen to this interview, will go back to your website and the Instagram pages and those kinds of things to see your work if they don't know it already. But could you talk a little bit about your work and what you're, I guess, what you're trying to achieve with it? What is it that interests you about the work that you do?
Well, I'm very. I said if I had to sum my work up in a sentence, I would say it's work that's based on landscape. Now, landscape is a you can make landscape as narrow as a, or as broad as you like. You can go out into the country and that's landscape. But I also think you could be in an empty room and that is also a kind of landscape.
For sure.
So I take influence from pretty much anything and everything. I mean, luckily now with mobile phones, I don't have to carry a camera around because you've always got your phone with me. I'm always taking photographs. I always carry a sketchbook. I'm always seeing things that I just think, oh, that's quite interesting. And it may be a color, it may be a pattern, it may be a texture, it may be something, I don't know. And I've got thousands of these things, most of which I never look at again. But if I do come across them, I kind of think, oh, that's quite good. But basically, life is there isn't enough time to do all the things that are buzzing around in my head at any one time. So I just have to kind of narrow it down. So I would describe my work as based on landscape. I also, my ethics is that I'm trying to make something which is beautiful and something which is timeless, but is also modern. So it's a contemporary piece of work. I mean, we're all governed by history because we live, yesterday was history, and in an hour's time, this meeting will be history, so history is happening to us all the time, but history also goes back, millennium and all the rest of it. So you can look at, I don't know, Stone Age axes all the way up to, something done in the things done in the 1930s, whether it's textiles, paintings, motor cars, buildings, or whatever. And they all have an influence on you. So your work is never just a now. It is always based, I mean, this is how I see it. It is always based on what has gone before and your experience of what has gone before. So, if you have never visited a particular museum, you will never be influenced by the things that are in that museum. But if you have visited that museum, you will be influenced by them. So therefore, and that all feeds into my head, and it all gets churned around, and then I'll do some drawing, and then I will go into the workshop and start making work. I mean, I'm making started a piece of work yesterday, which is based on a photograph I took in the winter of ice on a water tank that I've got that irrigates my plants in my greenhouse, which is again nothing really like what I do. The shapes are nothing really like what I do at the moment, but maybe in a year's time they will be what I do. But it's at such an early stage that I have no idea whether this will work or won't work. And there's no point me trying to describe it because I don't really know quite where it's going yet myself. So, so I'll go into the studio and I'll be starting work like that, and then I'm doing things which I suppose, are more usual, or in a sense maybe a little bit easier for me to make. But I'm still trying to put the whole kind of integrity and make them the best piece of work that I can possibly make at that time. I mean, I don't know who said it, but somebody said that, the best work that you make is the work that you're going to make tomorrow. And there's a lot of truth in that, but what you do now should be the best you can do at that moment, regard, whatever the circumstances that you're in at that moment. And it might not be as good as something you made 6 months ago, but it might be better. But you should always strive that it should be better. I mean, if I open a kiln, like I opened the kiln on, what's today, Friday, on Monday, with a piece of work in that, which took me forever to decorate, which is a pattern which was derived from my last trip to China. And it took me forever to, and I didn't know whether it would work, and it came out absolutely fantastically. And I thought, oh, that's brilliant. I was really, really pleased. But my next thought was, right, I need to try and, if that shape was a little bit taller or it was a little bit wider, that would make a difference. And if I made this pattern a bit like that, or a bit chase it like that, that could be even better. I'll do that next. So it's the any kind of joy I get out of my work is very, very short-lived. So, which I, I'm not worried. To me, that's kind of great because it means I'm kind of still alive and thinking, if you like. So.
Yeah, for sure. And it sounds like to me then what happens today in the kiln, whether it's a positive experience or something that's disappointing, speaks to the evolution of your work that tomorrow will be yet something a little bit different.
And if it goes, and if there's something that it's gone completely wrong for whatever reason, there is a reason why it went wrong, and I need to know that reason. So, it's that old, again, that old thing that you learn more from your mistakes than you do from your successes, because you think about, your successes, you kind of, if you like, sort of, glory in them, and then they're just there. Whereas your failures, you tend to kind of angst about and get upset about, which means you think about them more, which means then you have more ways of actually solving them. So,
Could you talk a little bit about your technique? And of course, feel free to give away as many secrets as you like, or not. But you have a multi-layered surfaces, at least that's how I see it, and with multiple colors, and I'm sure multiple ingredients. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to your work that way?
right. Well, I've got two distinct pieces of work. One piece of work, which is wax, uses wax as a resist to create patterns and texture. And then the other set of work, which I call groundwork, which is extremely difficult to do, and I probably only make about 10 pieces a year of that work, because each piece takes up to 6 months to make, and it's so time consuming that I just can't kind of face doing so much of it, basically. But we'll start with the wax resist work. I mean, basically, I start with a surface and I put a glaze on all over. And I work, as I said, with matte and semi-matte glazes. And then basically with a brush, I paint patterns. And depending on what those patterns can be. And then I apply other glazes on top. And depending on how those glazes chemically react with each other depends then on the color and texture. So, and that's a fairly straightforward technique. I mean, the only thing that I would as a tip in with that technique is that it's better done in a warm place than a cold place. The wax that you buy in the UK, I don't know about other countries, which you, I mean, you, it's the same wax seems to be sold all over the world, apart from China. The wax comes is too thick, and if you dilute it about 10%, it works better. You can get longer lines with it. And because it dries clear and it's difficult to see, if you put food coloring in it, I use black. When you paint it on something, you can see where you painted it. So
Great tip.
that's kind of good. The other work that I make is what I call the groundwork, and then and all of that work is thrown. I start up with a smooth surface, and then with all a very wide range of tools, from sponges, cake icing thing, guns, slip trailers, you name any way that you can think of. I put on layers of glaze, thin layers of glaze, in a textured manner. And I use clays which are different to the clay that the pot is made out of. So the difficulty is that because all these clays have a different shrinkage, if you don't do them at just the right stage, when you leave the piece to dry and you then biscuit fire, the whole surface falls off. And because it's taken months to get to that stage, then you have to do it very carefully. So I build up all these layers of different colors, and I build them up till I get about a centimeter thick. So I've then got this very textured object vessel. So in biscuit fired, it's then glazed normally twice. And I then grind the surface back. And as you grind into the surface, a bit like an MRI scan, all the textures and colors and patterns that you've built up within the structure get revealed. And the important thing is knowing when to stop, because if you go too far and it then isn't as good as it was before you went too far, you can't go back. So I've learned that as soon as it looks good, I stop, regardless of whether I think that there's a good chance I could improve it, because experience has told me that that's not necessarily the case. And then I start off, I use a diamond, an air-powered water-fed angle grinder with diamond discs on it. I start off coarse, get it to how I want it. Then I go finer and finer and finer and finer till it has a surface. It's textured, but the top surface is like polished marble. And nearly everybody who looks at them and then touches them always reacts when they touch them with a sort of, oh, blimey. And if they're with some, feel the surface of it, because they don't look like they how they feel. So which I like, because that's a kind of little surprise for people. So that's kind of basically, and I making wise, apart from the groundwork which is thrown, I'm slab building, throwing, occasionally do a bit of coiling. I mean, I was fortunate that when I was, because of my age, when I was at the college that I was, though I wasn't in a, a degree ceramics course, I was taught everything. So I know how to make molds. I know how to slip cast. I know how to make press molds. I know how to throw. I know how to hand build. I have a wide range of skills. So, and I'm fortunate in that way that I've never had an idea that I've looked at and thought, oh, I'm not sure I can do that. I've always known that, oh, well, that would be best if, and I need to make a mold for that, or I need to whatever. And so I'll use whatever technique is will get the job done, basically.
The like I wonder if you've got an idea of how you intuitively approach the work versus kind of intellectually approach the work. I know that may sound weird, but it sounds like you're intuitive in terms of how you approach, like this recent work you're talking about, that you have to grind off. You're trusting your visual perception, I guess, to say, hey, that's enough. Don't go any further. Does that make sense?
I mean, I suppose I yes, I suppose I am quite intuitive. I mean, I do have a kind of strange quality that if I'm mixing up a slip and it's too thick, my mouth feels dry. But if I add water to it, there comes a point where I kind of think, oh, that's ready. And I've always had that, and I have no idea why. I've never actually told anybody this before. And so I do have, I suppose I do have quite an intuitive kind of way of working. And I suppose I'm not particularly intellectual in approach to my work, in so much that, some people have kind of great stories about things that they, I mean, normally more sculptural ceramics rather than but like I said before, I just want to make beautiful objects, and I want somebody to, because the greatest compliment that anybody can pay me is by buying a piece of my work, because they are using their hard-earned money to own a piece of my work,
Absolutely.
and therefore I owe them something in return, which is something that I hope they think is beautiful, but that they won't be looking at it in 10 years' time thinking, oh, I wish I hadn't bought that. I've sort of gone off it. I want them to still look at it and kind of think, gosh, that's really great. And that to me is enough of an achievement. I don't think it necessarily has to, have some great philosophical kind of effect on people. It just has to made their lives a little bit better, I suppose, if that doesn't sound too pompous.
No, it makes perfect sense to me. I think about many of the pieces that I've had in my house, whether it's a painting or clay or whatever the artistic component is. Some of them I've lost interest in over the years, and others have stayed out in the house and have a story attached to them. Often it's, where I bought it or who I bought it from or what I was doing when I saw it or something, right? And I think that's what you're saying you're trying to achieve.
So as long as I can do that, and and as long as I'm physically able to carry on, I'll carry on. So
Yeah, do you make one-offs? Like, are your pieces a sing? Okay.
I mean, basically, I mean, I may, if I sit down and do some throwing, then I will probably throw in one session maybe 10 pieces. And they will be of all various shapes and sizes. So they may be very big things which are thrown in sections, or they may be very, quite small things. And then once I they are on the sort of the road to being finished, if I have some ideas to do some slab built work, then I may then roll some slabs out ready for doing that, and then the things will then begin to work alongside each other. But I never sit down and think, right, well, I've got this shape, this size piece of work, and this color sells very well, so I'm going to sit down and in and make 10 of those all the same, and decorate them all the same quickly, and then kind of great, they can go off and kind of because it earn me money, because the I'm not actually I'm interested in money in so much that money allows me to make more work. I have to eat, I have to pay for my house, I have to pay for life and my car and all the rest of it, but actually I'm not in the slightest bit interested in having lots of money. What I need is enough money so I don't have to worry about it, so I can put all my worry into my work. And so, I mean, again, when somebody buys a piece of work, that what they're giving me in exchange for that piece of work will enable me to go and make more work. So
Absolutely.
that's the kind of, the motivation of selling things, as opposed to, I mean, I have colleagues who actually the money is really quite important in the wrong kind of way, as far as I'm concerned. And I when I look at their work, I kind of think, yeah, I can tell because they're taking shortcuts, because that means they can make the work quicker. And if they didn't take the shortcuts, the work would be better. And it's the better part that to me is crucial at every stage, really.
So this is a great opportunity for me to ask you the question that I ask everybody, and that is,
Okay.
given your experience of training and selling and making and how you've approached your work, do you have a bit of advice that you might give to a person who's earlier on in their career?
I think the well, let's start at the very beginning. I mean, in this country, and I'm sure in Canada and other countries, you have to pay to go to college. If you could have the amount of money that it costs in the, for example, in the UK to go to college to do a ceramics degree, I wouldn't go to college. I'd divide that, if it was a 3-year course, I'd divide that money into 6 month chunks. I would then go and find a reasonably or sick or reasonably successful or successful maker, and I would offer them that 6 months money for you, for that person to go and work with them, and so basically be a 6 month apprentice, and then at the end of that 6 months they go and do another 6 month apprentice with somebody else doing something different, and at the end of the 3 years, which would be the same as the course, they would come out with an amazing amount, a level of skill and understanding about how to make work, which would be far more than the kind of teaching that you get in colleges and universities in this country now. And the staff at colleges and university, with the best will in the world, are trying their best, but their hands are tied in terms of teaching people skills, getting in, visiting lecturers, all this kind of thing. There just isn't the funding for it, and I think it's a kind of shame. So that would be that bit. But if you've gone through the course and you come out, I would say very few people their career is kind of meteoric. You know, suddenly they're picked up and they kind of become kind of great stars, and their career just kind of carries on. There's going to be times when it is not going very well. It's going to be hard, but you have to remember that it is what you want to do. And as long as you keep doing it and you keep banging away and banging away, you will eventually succeed. But if you're not prepared to do that, then I would suggest that you go and do something else. And again, I'm of a generation where I am a digital immigrant as opposed to a digital native. And so, somebody who is a kind of young coming out now, I would say to them, embrace wholeheartedly all the opportunities that technology can give you to get your work out there, get it known, and improve it, I think would be what I would say. But it's that you have to want it. You have to really, really want to do it. I mean, I've done a little bit of teaching in colleges and universities many years ago. And we'd have a class of, or a year group of maybe 25 students. I could tell you within the first 2 months of teaching them which ones were going to succeed and which ones weren't. And okay, there were some exceptions that didn't kind of come to, but that was because they really, really, really loved what they were doing. And then there were the others who were kind of there because they couldn't really think of anything to do, and they seemed like a quite a nice idea, and it and you just knew that it just was. I mean, they were having fun and enjoying themselves and making nice things and all the rest of it, but you just knew that they were never going to have a career in ceramics. They'd have a career in something else, and they'd do very well. They'd have an education, so that's great. It's part of an education. So there's no, just because you go to a college and do a particular course doesn't mean that what you're going to do for the rest of your life. So, but if it's what you really want to do, then you'll succeed.
What I hear you talking about is a couple of factors, but one is about heart, and you really need to feel strongly about what you're doing and have a love of it, and also have some resilience to be able to manage the challenges that go along with creating a career in the arts, because it's not easy. It's difficult in all of the arts.
Yeah, and one thing I would say about the ceramics community, I mean, I don't know what it's like around the world, but in this respect, but I do know in the UK that if you're somebody starting out, if you contacted somebody who has a successful career and asked, could you come and chat to them for an hour? See if you can, maybe bring two or three pieces of work and get some advice and all the rest of it. I don't know anybody who wouldn't say you're more than welcome. Let's make an appointment, and they'll help you basically, which is great. So.
It's a lovely community. And to that, I want to thank you for being with us today. Your comments have been very wise, and of course, I really do hope that people connect with you and your work, because it is so exquisite. And so thank you so much for joining us today. And
Thank you for your kind remarks. Yeah, so that's great. Thank you very much.